From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. More than 29,000 troops have reportedly been wounded as the Iraq War heads into its sixth year. When they come home, these wounded veterans often face mounds of red tape. Then there are the crumbling facilities. Last year, an investigation found that some vets staying at the Walter Reed Army Medical Center were recovering in moldy, rodent-infested rooms. So the White House appointed a bipartisan group to look into the military's entire medical care system. It's known informally as the Dole Shalala Commission. World War II veteran and former Senator Bob Dole was appointed co-chair. He split the role with Donna Shalala, former Health and Human Services Secretary in the Clinton administration. The commission recommended a slate of improvements in veterans care. When we spoke earlier, former Secretary Shalala gave me an update on the report's main findings.
We have world-class medical care for our wounded warriors. From the time they're injured in the field of battle, they can be transported in 48 hours to a major medical center in the United States, either through Germany or directly to the United States, that the problems arise not during that portion of the care, but once they get out of the hospital and have to get their outpatient care, the coordination of the care leaves something to be desired. What they are experiencing is not unlike what Americans experience every day when they try to use the healthcare system. It's fragmented. It seems disorganized. When they finally get to the doctor, they get good attention. If they have to go into an operating room, they get world-class medicine. So the fact that it's disorganized did not surprise me. What did surprise me is that a single payer system, and that is the government paying for it, produced such a disorganized and program that was not seamless.
This commission, bipartisan commission with Bob Dole, got together, produced recommendations. Do you think that any of those recommendations have been implemented?
Yeah, actually, most of them are in the process of being implemented. One of the major recommendations was for those that are severely injured, they need both a recovery plan and a recovery coordinator. The reason for that is that their injuries are so complex that the idea of their families giving up their jobs and giving up their homes and coming out to a major medical center, having to spend the time coordinating their care is simply unacceptable. And so hiring a professional to do that, who's not going to be deployed next month back to Iraq or Afghanistan, is very important to the quality of their care and to their own future. And so the recovery coordinators are being hired, and we've always had care coordinators in the system, but when you have something that's really complex, you need a single person that does all the pieces for you, right until you get the benefits that you're eligible for.
We spoke with Dr. C. Martin Harris of the Cleveland Clinic, who served on your commission, and he also said that one of the things on the table was possibly to extend the Family Medical and Leave Act for caretakers of wounded veterans. Did that go anywhere? Is that in process?
As a matter of fact, that was introduced by a bipartisan group of members of Congress, it certainly passed one house, and I'm not quite sure where it is right now, but I do believe that will be implemented right away. That's not a very complex one, but what was needed more than anything else is making the system very seamless and not depending on family members to do all of the work that a professional healthcare person ought to be doing. And we ought to be paying for that kind of service, particularly for these very complex cases.
This commission came into fruition after reports that returning soldiers weren't getting adequate medical care at Walter Reed. Is there a sense now that the country is moving in a better direction in terms of making veterans a priority?
Yes, but remember, it wasn't that they weren't getting first-class medical care. It was that the facilities, after they left the hospital, that single individuals were placed in were terrible facilities. The famous Building 18, I guess it was, at Walter Reed. Has that been cleaned up? I think the administration moved immediately on Walter Reed. The underlying problem, though, is the fragmentation of the healthcare system and our need to make it seamless. And that includes having a seamless medical record so that when you leave the care of the military and go to the VA, it's a seamless transition for you.
Working with Abdul, who is himself a recovered war vet who had serious injuries that he will carry with him for the rest of his life, what did you learn about what it must be like? Most of us will never be in that position, but what did you learn from working with him or from just doing this work in general?
Well, in addition to Senator Dole, who of course received his injuries, which are life-changing, in World War II, we had two recent veterans of the Iraqi war, both of whom were severely injured, on our panel, and the wife of an injured service member, and another disabled healthcare leader who heads the Washington Rehab Center. So we had a lot of people with real day-to-day expertise. And I'll tell you what we learned. We learned to listen to people who have actually been through the experience in terms of what they needed to recover and what they needed to have successful lives. It was, for me, a remarkable experience because the panel was not made up of the usual suspects who represented major constituencies, but rather of people who had real life experience who could talk about those experiences. And as a result, our recommendations were patient-centered.
What about mental illness? There's been a spike in suicide among veterans. There's been a lot of brain injuries that could affect mood as well as other things. How much did you focus on the mental dimensions of and what did you recommend specifically on that count?
One of our major recommendations, remember we only had six recommendations, we recommended lifetime care for those who have post-traumatic stress disorder, as well, of course, of those that were already covered with TBI, traumatic brain injury. In addition to that, it became very apparent as we listened to both the wounded warriors, their families, as well as the military themselves, that this mental health has taken on a different dimension. This is a war of head injuries. And it's a war in which, for the first time, we are embedding mental health professionals into the units themselves. And we're just at the beginning of learning about all of these things. But I think that the military is as up-to-date as anyone that I know about trying to get out to the field and anticipate and treat as quickly as possible these traumatic experiences.
Now, the president's fiscal year 2009 budget provides $41 billion for veterans' medical care. That's an increase of $2.3 billion from the 2008 budget. Is that enough of an increase to get done some of the many things we've talked about?
Well, let me put it this way. Much of what we recommended required that both the military and the VA do things differently, not necessarily new resources. But some of the things we recommended definitely require new resources. The president has started the process of investing in those resources that are needed. But I'm never going to say we've done enough or we have enough resources dedicated to these brave young men and women.
Now, since you served as a cabinet official during the Clinton administration, you must know intimately what it takes to keep your issues on the agenda. And in an environment like there is today, with an election going on, with the war going on, with the economy, what does it take for someone, you know, whether it's someone who's inside the Bush administration or people who are in Congress, what does it take to keep veterans' health on the agenda in a time when there's so many competing demands?
Well, it obviously takes political leadership. It also takes administrative leadership. And what's impressive is that Secretary Gates and the new Secretary of VA have their deputies meeting on a regular basis to discuss the recommendations and how far they are in the implementation. My own experience is that the bureaucracy, if it's committed, can get more done when the White House and the rest of the political leadership is distracted because there's no interference. And they're not asking you to do all sorts of other things. So that I believe that a combination of these meetings and the White House domestic policy staff literally keeping an eye on every detail really does make a difference. And I believe there has been progress. It's why we wrote a very strategic report, putting most of the pressure on the president. Now, our major recommendations on disability, on changing the disability system, on modernizing it, are not yet getting bipartisan, serious attention from the Congress. And that's in large part because of the politics that are going on at this time.
It's been 5 years since the start of this war. 5 years from now, where would you like to see veterans' health care?
Oh, well, look, I don't think we should take 5 years. I think a year after the election, we should get every single piece in place, including the recommendations on disability. And getting modernizing the disability system is critical. And there's some disagreement among the veterans groups. Some believe that this generation of veterans should not get different benefits than previous generations. I think each generation ought to get better benefits. That's the way I feel about myself. I hope that the new generation gets a better education, has a better opportunity for a future. And that's the way we ought to think about Americans. We ought to want each generation to have better opportunities and better resources so that they can live better lives.
President Shalala, thank you.
You're welcome.
Donna E. Shalala is the president of the University of Miami and the co-chair of the Dole Shalala Commission. She's also the former Health and Human Services Secretary under President Clinton. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Many active duty soldiers and veterans of the war in Iraq and Afghanistan are dealing with their own personal battles. Some have come home with nightmares, flashbacks, and emotional hypersensitivity. Some are also diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. Today, we continue our series on mental health with a closer look at the disorder in the men and women of the military. In a few minutes, we'll talk to Robert Jenkins. He's an attending psychologist at the Men's Trauma Recovery Program at the National Center for PTSD in the Menlo Park, a division of the Department of Veterans Affairs. Right now we have June Moss. She served as a staff sergeant in Iraq in 2003. 2 years later, the Army released her on an early medical retirement because of PTSD. Welcome, June.
Hello.
So I really want to thank you for coming on and telling us about what you've been through. Let's start with your service. How long had you been in the Army before you were deployed to Iraq in 2003?
I had been in approximately 9 or 10 years.
And was this the first time that you went to war? How long did you end up staying in Iraq?
This was my first war experience. I was in Iraq for approximately 8 months, but it wasn't my first deployment, serious deployment.
What do you mean it wasn't your first serious deployment?
Well, I went to Kosovo in 99. And that was experience prepared me for Iraq, actually.
What was it like in Kosovo? Let's start there. I mean, what was, did you feel safe? Did you feel protected? What was your daily life like?
Being there, I felt a lot of mixed emotions. We were pretty much inside of the perimeter most of the time when I was in Kosovo, so I did feel safe. That experience was just, it wasn't horrific like being in Iraq. I wasn't being shot at or I wasn't around explosives on a constant level.
Now, when you went to Iraq, what was your job?
I was a light wheel vehicle mechanic, actually. I got to fix a lot of Humvees, deuce and a halves, a lot of heavy trucks.
And what were your days like in terms of, again, feeling safe or being under fire? Were you ever in a position where you felt that your life was in danger?
I felt my life was in danger from the time we crossed into the border of Iraq. From that day on until we left there, I did feel immediate danger. I didn't feel safe at all. And even after we returned, I still felt unsafe.
Let's, before we turn to what happened when you returned, what kind of facility were you in? Were you in a walled compound? Were you out in the open desert? I mean, how much did you feel protected by your surroundings?
Well, as we were traveling, we were out in the desert, obviously, and we had a perimeter set up. And pretty much everyone was inside of the perimeter. When we felt still a level of being unsafe, and then when we moved closer to Iraq, we were in a walled compound, but that still didn't make you feel as safe if you would be sleeping in your own bed back in the United States.
What was the moment that you felt the least safe?
Entering the border of Iraq.
Hmm.
When I initially passed the border, that's when I initially it started feeling unsafe. The even though we were trained and we were ready, it's still no matter amount of training you have, it doesn't prepare you for it until you actually are in it.
So, you have two children.
Yes, I do.
How old were they when you left for Iraq?
My daughter Brianna was 6 and my son Jacob was 5.
Do you think they understood what it meant for you to deploy? Do you think they understood what it meant for you to be going away?
Well, I explained to them, and they were very young, but they were very smart. And I told them that mommy was going to help some people rid a bad man, and they understood that.
So did you get to talk to them at all, either on, sat phone, letters, emails, while you were gone?
Yes, we did get to send them emails and letters. It wasn't every day that I got to talk to them because there would be a 2-hour wait for the telephone. Everybody was waiting to call their family, and you only get to spend maybe 5-10 minutes on the telephone because there were so many people waiting. So I got to talk to them as often as I could.
So you might expect that, when you got home, that things would be better, but it sounds like they were not, or at least things were not completely better. When did you first notice, once you had gotten home, that you didn't feel the way that you had hoped?
I got home in August of 2003, and around late September, early October, is when it really just hit me, the crying bits, the not sleeping, the constant checking my surroundings to make sure the house was secure, making sure my children were safe. That's when it pretty started then.
So you would wander around the house just making sure everything was locked down?
Yes.
Did your children notice that something was different?
They did notice, and when I would see them starting to check the doors, starting to come and say, "Mommy, are you okay?" That's when I noticed that I needed to get some help because I started seeing their behavior changing.
You were also married at the time you deployed, and your husband also deployed. That must have been an incredible strain on your family. How did he end up dealing with the stress of deployment?
Unfortunately, he turned to alcoholism, and he wouldn't receive help once we returned. It was just really hard on our family to go through that.
And when did you first reach out for help?
Once I saw the kids really going through the changes, I went to the doctor immediately and started getting help.
Now, I'm going to bring in Robert Jenkins, who's at the National Center for PTSD. But before we bring him on, tell me what kind of treatment they offered you. What was it like when they offered you treatment? What kind of treatment was it?
Well, in 2003, I was still active duty with the Army, so I was able to see a psychiatrist on a weekly basis and as an outpatient. And I would go in and see him weekly, Dr. Morgan. He was great.
Well, let me bring in Robert right now. Robert, when you are listening to this story about how hard it is to come back home. Does it call up experiences for some of the patients that you're dealing with?
Yes, it sounds very, very familiar and very typical of what we see at the VA when working with post-traumatic stress disorder. It's fortunate that June was able to understand that she probably needed to reach out and get some assistance. Many people don't get the assistance as readily and as quickly as she sought to get it for herself.
And when it comes to being someone who not only has PTSD, well, first of all, let's back up a little bit. PTSD is a term that is much more common now in terms of people using it in everyday conversation or reading it in the newspaper. But what exactly does it mean, ranging from, you know, one of the more manageable symptoms to some of the more extreme symptoms?
Well, post-traumatic stress disorder is in the diagnostic manual under the anxiety disorders. And so when you understand what post-traumatic stress disorder is, people have to have been exposed to something that was life-threatening, and they had to have had some kind of response to it that involves fear or concern about the horrific things that they were exposed to. And then from there, people have a lot of symptoms that many of us talk about. Sometimes you hear people talking about flashbacks, like re-experiencing the event as if it's happening right now, even though it may have been months or years ago. Having problems falling or staying asleep, having problems with concentration, having what we call hypervigilance, where you're scanning the environment, making sure things are safe, or you can't sit out in the middle of a restaurant, you have to sit up against the wall, or startle response. You may have heard people talking about startle response, where they hear a car backfire or fireworks, and they think they're back in their war zone theater where the bullets are flying or the IEDs are exploding. So those are the kinds of things that people go through that interfere with their day-to-day functioning, or their functioning with their loved ones, or the functioning when their various occupations, that it keeps them unsettled. They're not quite able to feel that they're walking on solid ground, and they're very concerned about other people seeing them have the reactions also. There's a real concern about looking different. And so many people will try to keep the symptoms to themselves because they are concerned that people will begin to have concerns about them, will stigmatize them, and they will look not as normal as the other people that they're working with.
June, did you ever worry? You say that your husband didn't get help and you did get help. Did you ever think, gosh, you know, I don't want people to find out about this. I don't want to talk about it. Obviously, right now, you are talking about it, and we're very grateful for that. But did you ever have a moment when you didn't want to be public about it?
Yes, very. My family didn't believe that going to the doctor was a good thing, that the doctor couldn't possibly help you. There's nothing that's wrong with you, that you would need the doctor or that you would need to take the medication, that just prayer alone and your family should just fix it. And I felt that all of that together, including the doctor and the medication, would be best.
But when you first started treatment, it didn't resolve all the problems, did it? I mean, what were some of the hardest moments for you? Well, first of all, you ended up leaving on a medical basis. What was your reaction to that? Were you angry? Were you accepting as you were no longer on active duty?
That was a very, very hard thing to do. I felt betrayed by the Army for some reason during that time, because all I knew at the moment was the Army. 12 years of being with my fellow soldiers. And then once I did what I had to do and fought for our country and I came home, then it was as if, oh, you're sick now, we don't need you anymore. So I did feel that a sense of anger, a sense of abandonment, betrayal.
Is that common, Robert?
Yes, it is. There's a concern about, especially as people are going through the military and they're wanting it to be more as a career. And as they go through the process of being impacted by the war zone experiences, it may impact upon their ability to function as a soldier or Marine that they have wanted to be, or the military expects them to be. And so the military may work with them to transition out of the military, possibly to get the help that they need, or to go into civilian life. And that can be very disheartening because, again, if a person is expecting to have a long-time career, they then have to deal with the loss of what they thought their dream was or their future was. And that's hard for them to then, again, restabilize because they're concerned about, well, what am I going to do now, as June was saying. I haven't had any plans to not be in the military, so if I'm not in the military, what's my identity? Who am I going to be? How are people going to perceive me? Am I going to be perceived as a failure? Do I see myself as a failure? How are my family members or my children going to see me? So it brings up all those issues. And then, of course, you still have to bring food and have money for your family also. So it brings up a lot of stresses that people have a hard time dealing with. And so at the VA, we're trying to work with people not only to begin to confront those issues, but also to figure out how to help them to make the transition into the civilian life also.
What is the biggest success that you think you've had in terms of, you know, knowing what to do for treatment now as opposed to, say, what would have been treatment 10 years ago or 15 years ago?
Is that for June or for myself?
It's for you. You know, I mean, in terms of you as someone who's in the field, have things advanced in the kinds of techniques that you used?
Yeah, many things have advanced in terms of how we can work with people in a group setting, working with them to address their trauma issues and being able to help them, help the men and the women in a supportive way to confront their issues together so individuals don't feel that they're alone and that there's actually some commonality. And so for many people with post-traumatic stress disorder, they experience it as a private experience. And we can have people come into, say, a residential program at the trauma recovery programs for both the men and the women, they're able to see that they're not alone, that they can have support, that they can struggle together, that they actually can have a future. They begin to look at how they can get into vocational rehab or seek employment and begin to learn how to function in a civilian mode as well as understand what skills that they need to survive in a civilian mode. So we've seen a lot of people begin to learn how to function in a better way in the years I've been working with post-traumatic stress disorder.
June, how's your life today? How have things unfolded? Are you and your children, do you feel emotionally secure?
My life today, oh, that's a good one. I do feel emotionally secure to a degree. I'm still working on that, but as far as my kids, they are great. They are really therapeutic. And by the grace of God, I'm still here. I'm still standing. I'm still strong. If it hadn't been for my faith and my belief and my family and the VA and my medical attention, everything, all that in the whole, I could not be here. I would not be holding a job. I would be homeless just like, you know, like thousands that we have now. So, yes, emotionally, I'm doing a lot better than I was 3 years ago, 5 years ago, a lot better.
I'm glad to hear that. June, Robert, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We've been speaking with June Moss. She served as an Army Staff Sergeant in Iraq in 2003. Also, Robert Jenkins. He's an attending psychologist at the Men's Trauma Recovery Program at the National Center for PTSD in Menlo Park. That's with the Department of Veterans Affairs. They spoke with us from the studios at Stanford University. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. We don't usually think of video war games as therapy, but researchers are finding ways to use virtual reality to help soldiers deal with what they've experienced in combat. Skip Rizzo is a clinical psychologist and a research scientist at the Institute for Creative Technologies at the University of Southern California. He's helped to develop a PTSD therapy he calls Virtual Iraq. Hi, Skip.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So the idea of a virtual universe is to simulate reality for the viewer. And in this case, does that mean really simulating war?
In order to treat PTSD effectively, we often rely on what's called exposure therapy, and that is to get people to revisit the trauma and to emotionally process those memories and the negative things that happened to them. As long as you avoid reprocessing these memories or re-experiencing them in a therapeutic fashion, they're going to continue to haunt you. So that is why we go to the trouble and expense to create a virtual Iraq environment in which the person can ever so gradually re-experience what they went through in Iraq, but in a safe, supportive environment in the clinician's office. So yes, we do replicate war, but not, of course, to the level of intensity, and certainly not at a level that is too much for a patient to handle.
Who exactly are the patients that you're dealing with?
We have a number of sites, but our primary research site is down in San Diego at the Naval Medical Hospital. This is a project that was funded by the Office of Naval Research. So we have active duty naval and marine personnel that are going through the treatment there. But across the nation, we've got about 20 sites that work with people in the Army and Air Force, National Guard, reservists, and so forth.
So take me through an experience. If I were a patient and I sat down and put on these goggles that I've seen in newspaper accounts of what you're working on, what would I see? What would you tell me? What would you do if I panicked?
Right. Well, the one thing to keep in mind is when you're in a virtual reality environment wearing a virtual reality head-mounted display, as you move your head around, the computer updates the graphics so that you get the sense of being immersed within whatever environment is modeled. So we put a pair of headsets on a person, and they're also sitting on a base shaker platform so they actually can feel vibration. We also have a smell machine that pumps smells into the space that are relevant for what the person is going to experience. And, of course, we have good sound. So when you're in the environment, you get the illusion that you're either going down a desert road through Iraq or you're walking through a desert city, through a marketplace, through ramshackle buildings and so forth. But we can systematically begin to ramp up the provocative nature of the environment. So we can click a button and a gunshot in the distance is heard, or a gunshot right next to your head is heard, or an IED can be exploded, or an insurgent can come out from behind some palm trees, or the Humvee that's in front of you can blow up.
Well, Skip, let me ask you this. I mean, how do you decide who is eligible for treatment and who's responding? And have you ever had bad responses? I can imagine that you might.
Well, no, we actually, so far in our research, we haven't had any situations where somebody yanks off the headset and runs out of the room. That never has happened. And I think that's more of a tribute to the therapists that are working in this area and not necessarily to the technology. A good therapist is monitoring the patient very closely, watching their heart rate, their skin conductance, their respiration. We record all of these physiological measures of stress, as well as they're in full audio contact with the patient. The idea here is that you put a person in an environment at a level that they can handle with only a little bit of anxiety, and that eventually that anxiety extinguishes or habituates, i.e. the person gets used to the environment, and then they're able to take on a little bit more.
You just had your first round of patients complete a full course of therapy, which I understand is 10 to 12 sessions, roughly. What were some of the results that you got from those patients?
Well, thus far, we're really encouraged with what we've seen. We've had 14 people go through the complete treatment, and of that number, 11 no longer meet the criteria for PTSD. And I don't want to, you know, go beyond that data, but I think that's rather encouraging considering that these were active duty participants that had just gotten back, had tried other forms of treatment without any success. So, you know, we're feeling that we're on the right track, but we still have quite a bit more work to do in order to, you know, really validate that this is a successful treatment. But one thing to keep in mind is that the VR is a tool to deliver exposure therapy. And thus far, exposure therapy has been supported as the best validated treatment procedure for PTSD of all forms of treatment. This was documented by the National Academy of Science last fall and in other sources as well. So what we're doing is we're able to do this exposure therapy, but in a much more controlled and a much more provocative fashion. So I think we're resting on good ground, that we're operating from good theoretical principles and accepted treatment practices.
Skip, thanks so much.
All right. Well, thank you.
Skip Rizzo is a clinical psychologist and a research scientist at the Institute for Creative Technologies at the University of Southern California. He's part of a team working on virtual reality treatments for post-traumatic stress disorder. To see clips of virtual Iraq, just go to our site, nprnewsandnotes.org. Time now for a look at the week in sports with our very own Tony Cox. Hey, Tony.
Hey, Farai. You went to Harvard, right?
Oh, yeah.
Now, what did you think of their basketball program?
Well, let's see. I went to the Harvard-Yale football game. I watched the regatta on the Charles. But I'll be perfectly honest, I never saw a basketball game.
You know what? A lot of other people didn't see them either because they really weren't worth watching. And that's why Harvard has been trying lately to lift the profile of its basketball program by raising its athletic standards. But the question is, at what cost? And that is what we're talking about today with New York Times sports columnist Bill Roten. So, hey, Bill, how you doing?
The great Tony Cox. How you doing, man?
I'm doing great, man. You know, this seems to be about Harvard's tradition of academic standards versus its new aspirations for athletic achievement. Simply put, they want to win an Ivy League basketball title, something they've done only, well, never. The Crimson hired a new coach last year, Tommy Amaker, as we all know, an African-American who had had winning teams at Seton Hall and Michigan. So what does he do? Well, Bill, he starts recruiting ball players who may or may not meet Harvard's strict academic standards. And that's when things got a little strange, didn't they? Your paper, in fact, the New York Times, wrote a piece a few weeks ago kind of blasting Amaker and the program. So where do things stand now?
Yeah, well, you know, Pete Thamel, who's a really excellent reporter, did the story and wrote the story and broke the story. And after that, one of their recruits, big 7-foot kid, decided he's not going to Harvard, is threw his name back in the larger shark tank. And, you know, Tony, it raises a lot of interesting questions about this whole idea of special admits, which, as you know, every university has what they call special admits. That is, kids who have, you know, unique talents, be they music or arts or drama, whatever, and they may not necessarily fit the profile of your sort of typical student, but the administration feels that they can do the work, and B, they've got gifts that are unique. I think the rub is always when you deal with athletics. You know, people say, well, I don't know, should athletics be recognized? And you're right. And Harvard, you know, they're about to get an African-American as president of the United States. They say, well, why can't we win the Ivy League championship?
Maybe they need to get Barack to come back and play with
and
them.
He can't play, and Barack can't play basketball.
That's so. What I understand. All right, let's move on to talk about college basketball and the tournament, which kicks off this weekend. You know, everybody's talking about the top seeds, UCLA, North Carolina, Kansas, Memphis. But there are stories behind the stories every year. What's a good one this year?
There's so many of them. And where I am out east, Baylor is playing. 5 years ago, Baylor was just one of the awful tragedies in college basketball. Patrick Dennehy was murdered, found shot in the head, and as it turns out, one of his teammates was accused and convicted of doing it. It was just awful. Well, the coach, Dave Bliss, was fired, and turns out that he had been paying almost $40,000 to his athletes, and it was just an awful scene. Well, here they are, 5 years later, and they're in the NCAA tournament, probably for a brief amount of time, but they're back. And it's a curious story, Tony. I mean, just like we talked about Harvard, now we talk about, you know, wanting to win. Now we talk about Baylor, coming back, and you kind of wonder what is so important about having this, you know, basketball piece in your university, that keeping the program through tragedies. And Baylor is I think, a very good non-basketball story.
Interesting story. Talking about other stories, let's go from the big round ball to the little white ball that people knock in those holes every day around the country and around the world. Can you believe, Bill, Tiger Woods? I mean, last weekend, he won his fifth straight PGA Tour win. He did it in remarkable fashion, coming back from six strokes, I think, to win on Sunday at Bay Hill by one stroke. Now, if he wins this weekend at Doral, he will pass the legendary Ben Hogan with 65 Tour victories, and then he can set his sights on Augusta, which comes up next. Now, the streak is still owned by Byron Nelson at 11, but Tiger's getting closer, so there's Nelson, Nicklaus, and Hogan. But is it still too early to say that we are now seeing the best there ever was in Tiger Woods?
Tony, no. I think you could already say that. Tiger is the best golfer that's ever played the game, period. Going beyond that, without gushing too much, he dominates his sport like no other athlete has dominated his or her sport. I think it's hands down, and it's just a matter of time before he passes everybody. I think that by the time Tiger Woods decides to say, I don't want to play anymore, he will have set so many records that it's probably going to take, I'd say, maybe a couple generations of golfers to come close to surpassing him. I mean, it's, you begin to run out of words to describe what this man has done in this sport.
He's almost as good a golfer as you are a sports writer. Ain't that right?
Oh, Tony, you're so kind.
Bill Roden, we always love having you on the show. We'll talk to you again.
Hey, thanks, Tony.
That was NPR's Tony Cox speaking with our regular sports commentator, William C. Roden. Roden is a sports columnist for the New York Times and author of Third and a Mile, The Trials and Triumphs of the Black Quarterback. It's Thursday. That's when we read through your letters. Here to help is NPR producer and editor Christopher Johnson. Hey, Christopher.
Farai Chidea, how you feeling?
Most excellent. What's up first?
All Barack, all the time. We got a grip of letters about our coverage of Obama's relationship with his outspoken former pastor, Jeremiah Wright, and your guest, Ronald Kessler, chief Washington correspondent for Newsmax.com, had some particularly strong criticisms of Wright.
This, you know, hatred of America is pretty shocking. And what he says is that America started the AIDS virus. America trains professional killers to kill people. America has oppressed blacks throughout the world. On and on and on and on. It's, of course, disturbing that anybody would want to go to a church like this.
Listener Cheryl Field in Golden Valley, Minnesota, wrote in with her own critique of that segment. Cheryl says, the argument Ronald Kessler was voicing during the interview was a great example of how racism is perceived through the lenses of white privilege. I'm a white woman and was unable to follow Mr. Kessler's point because they were shallow reaction points that devalued the deep experience of African Americans. This interview shined a hot spotlight on how privilege plus one-sidedness coupled with the lack of empathy can be dangerous. By the way, Farai is so good in these tense situations. That's why I love this show.
Hey, Cheryl, thanks a lot for that. And here's another about our conversations on Wright and Obama. P. Mahalik hit us up to say this. Reverend Wright should be saying, God save America, God help America, God change America, but that is not what he said. This is Senator Obama's church. If nothing else, this is a serious miscalculation on his part if he joined to show he is black enough.
We've been getting lots of love for our mental health series this week. Here's a letter from Anise Ritters in Athens, Georgia. It's about time that we start talking about the 600-pound elephant in the living room. As a member of an extended family whose members suffer from mental disorders that range from bipolar disorder, depression, schizophrenia, to various addictions, I urge you to continue to present information that sheds light on the help and treatment that is now available. Let's get rid of the stigma of needing help so that we can move forward into the light.
And here's another one, this time from Yvette Weaver-Lyons in New York. It has been so wonderful to listen to the pieces on mental health. Listening to Rebecca Walker was particularly moving for me. I wasn't diagnosed with bipolar disorder until my late 20s, when I began taking mood-stabilizing medications. I became pregnant shortly after. I, too, spent a long time agonizing over if I should or shouldn't continue with them. My husband and I researched and researched and in the end decided that I should go off them because of the side effects on the baby. I dipped into the deepest, darkest depression. It was nothing I could have ever imagined. I spent the last 4 months of my pregnancy in the hospital more times than not. It was my son who kept me going and not allowing the darkness to push me to harm myself. Once my son was born, I spent the next year in and out of the hospital. It has taken over 4 years and disability to get me stabilized. It has been anything but an easy road for me and my family. I have to share this because I think it is important for people to know that it is okay to take medications and that their lives can radically change. And I want to say, Yvette, I can't tell you how much I appreciate this. It's really, really important not to feel isolated. And the people we hear from, like you, are having a ripple effect on other folks' lives. So thank you.
And finally, just a little love for the show from listener Arthur Clark, who wrote to say, I started working in a new location about a year ago. The 20 to 25-minute ride was somewhat of a chore. Then I started listening to News and Notes, and the ride became magical. I love the show and its format. Thanks for a pleasant ride.
Hey, Arthur, thank you for the great note. It is our pleasure.
And that's it for letters, but please keep yours coming.
To write us, just log on to npr.org and click on Contact Us. When you get there, you'll see lots of shows to choose from. Make sure you pick News and Notes when you write to us. And be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name. Christopher, thanks.
Always a pleasure for us.